Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 24th of January. We watched the president's or listened to the president's State of the Union address and had a preview of the address yesterday. We've also had a lot of analysis today and will continue to do so during the course of the day. Was there an attempt toward the middle? What do you think about what he had to say concerning domestic issues, health insurance, immigration, trying to lessen our dependence on foreign oil? And what about those foreign issues, the war on terrorism, the war on Iraq, what's going on in terms of trying to reduce the number of people who are HIV infected in Africa? What about proposals to lower the number of people who contract malaria? We have much to discuss this hour, and I would imagine we'll have quite different perspectives. We have two guests with us at the same time. We do this every now and then, and it should be an interesting discussion. And, of course, we'll welcome your phone calls. Vlady Plushinsky is with us, editorial director of the American Spectator. Mr. Plushinsky, hello. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Mark Melman is also joining us. Mark is a Democratic strategist. He works with the Melman Group, .com. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. One of the things that came out of yesterday's discussion was there was a concern about whether or not anybody was going to watch the president's speech because he has his poll numbers are so low that the American people is not listening to him anymore. Did he make us want to listen to him again, Mr. Plushinsky?
Well, of course. He's the president of the United States. And I thought he did a tremendously good job. He was in confident form. He was in command of his remarks. And I thought his exit at the end, when he just sort of went through a gauntlet of admirers and people like Dennis Kucinich and Sheila Jackson Lee, showed that he still has the charisma that he displayed early on in his presidency. So I think to misunderstimate him is still a problem for those who do.
And what were the parts of the speech, the policies that were outlined that you thought were particularly good?
Well, I thought the health care proposal was an excellent way to get something new discussed in a prominent way. I thought the energy policy was disappointing and an invitation to a certain kind of crony capitalism and subsidized energy policies that can only, I think, create havoc with the market. I thought on foreign policy, he was staunch, strong. And again, I think he is forcing the Democrats to at least take a position, which they refused to.
Mark, what did you think about his overall comments? Was it an effective speech? Were there parts of it that you thought, I'm listening to this guy, I'm with him?
Well, there's no question that, as was said, he is the president of the United States, and one should listen carefully to what he said. I certainly did. And, you know, there were times when I was certainly moved. I mean, at the end of the speech, when he was talking about the subway hero from New York and the soldier who had risked his life in Iraq to save his comrades, those were very moving. I was in tears. I was a little less verklempt about the person who made $200 million. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, those were very moving stories. But you sit back for a moment, you say, you know what? George Bush really had nothing to do with either of those events. And if you think back on what he actually said in the speech, he embraced some positive goals. Yes, everybody wants to make us less dependent on Middle East oil. The president's come before the Congress 7 times and said that, but he hasn't actually done anything to make it happen. Similarly on health care, again, Democrats have been talking for a long time, as they have on energy, about reducing the cost of health care, but you don't reduce the cost of health care by taxing health care for tens of millions of Americans. So some of the goals were the right goals, but the proposals just don't match up to the goals. The devil's always in the details.
Yeah, let's spend a little bit more time on this health care proposal, because I didn't fully understand it, and it's not getting a lot of support today. It's interesting, Mr. Plushinsky, that you said that you were supportive of what he had to say. How is it going to lessen significantly the number of people, 47 million people in this country, who don't have health insurance?
Well, it will make it easier for people who don't have health insurance to get tax breaks and trying to get it. There will be certain incentives created in the market that will encourage people who don't have private health insurance to seek it out. It's not going to cost them as much as it would have beforehand. I mean, that's the idea. You saw Mitt Romney is very appreciative of this new proposal. He tried to get something along these lines passed, and they did get it passed in Massachusetts, it could prove a disaster because it's now in Democratic hands. But again, there are many efforts out there to create market incentives to drive down the cost of health insurance and health care in general.
Well, in fact, though, this is quite different from Governor Romney's proposal. With the specifics of what the president proposed are these. If you are $600 away from being able to afford a $4,000 a year health insurance policy, then this program will work for you. But you know what? There are not many people, uninsured people, who are $600 away from being able to afford the $4,000 it costs to be able to afford an insurance policy. And the flip side of this is what the president's saying is, if you have a good health insurance policy, if you have a health insurance policy that really covers a lot of your illnesses, he's going to tax you on that as income. So tens of millions of middle-class families that have good health insurance from their employers, that's never counted as part of their income for tax purposes before. What the president's saying now is, if you have a good health insurance plan from your employer, you're going to have to pay income tax on that in order to be able to give these very modest tax breaks to people who don't have insurance. We should not be asking, we should be covering the uninsured. We should not be asking the middle class to pay higher health care costs in order to cover the uninsured. And the reality is, the uninsured that we do want to cover won't really be helped by this plan.
Mr. Plushinski, it's hard to believe the middle class is going to go for that.
No, but again, I don't think it's necessarily the middle class that's being affected by this, as those who have, you know, very expensive policies, very super-duper policies that almost create incentives for them to get health care that they don't need. So they kind of create too much demand for health care when they don't need it. I mean, we are a nation that is somewhat hypochondriac, nation of hypochondriacs at this stage. We have so much health care out there that we can't help but use it because it's available. I think, you know, people, for instance, self-employed tend to use much less health care because they have incentives to work and not spend their working hours at the doctor's offices complaining about this or that possible ailment. And we have so much, such an emphasis on preventive health care that everyone's kind of extremely nervous that they're going to come down with something.
So yeah, we also have a lot of people who can't get good access. We just had the cancer rate death study released last week by the American Cancer Society showing a huge disparity among those who have and those who have not when it comes to being able to access the medical system in this country. So the cancer rates are much higher among, say, African-American men than among Caucasians. That's not good.
Well, and frankly, you know, there are not many people waking up this morning in America saying, you know what, thank you, Mr. President, I am using too much health care. I should have a lot less, and if I had a lot less health care, I'd be better off, and so would a lot of other people. There just aren't a lot of people waking up this morning with that view in mind. It may be Mr. Plushinski's, it may be the president's, but I guarantee you it's not a view widely shared in the country.
Immigration.
It's a cultural issue at work here, which we in a democracy like this, no politicians will address because they'll be afraid of the voters' reactions. But I do think we overemphasize health care.
Well, it is one of those issues that the American people say they would like something done about, and certainly businesses in this country. I don't understand. It's not a partisan issue. I don't understand. So please help me, both of you, why Congress and any administration has not addressed this in a very significant way for a long time. It needs to be addressed. People are hurting, businesses are hurting, and I think they're asking the government to fashion something that will help them.
Yeah, well, to expect government to deal with the problem is I think, rather naive. The reason we have such a tremendous problem with health care costs and total inability to control these costs is the fact that government is so involved in the system. And whenever the government gets involved in the system, prices go up. It's just the way it works. Socialism of one sort or another.
You think we have a socialist healthcare system?
Well, there are elements of it. It's such a holy mess that to unravel it would take a tremendous statistical genius to just kind of undo it all. The more we add to the system, the newer the regulations, the more efforts we inject to try to kind of make sense of it, just the bigger the problem seems to become.
Look at the difference, though, between what President Bush is proposing on the one hand and what Governor Doyle in Wisconsin is proposing on the other. President Bush is saying we're going to raise taxes on health care for tens of millions of Americans. What Governor Doyle has been saying is we ought to make health insurance premiums tax deductible for people. So most people actually pay less, as well as Governor Doyle has a program to take care of the uninsured. So President Bush is saying let's take care of a very few of the uninsured, those that are very close to being able to afford a policy, and let's tax people with good health insurance. What Governor Doyle is saying is let's make health insurance costs cheaper for everybody. Governor Doyle's approach, it seems to me, is a much better one than that being advocated by the president.
Let's move on to immigration. Do you think that here we might be able to find common ground? The guest worker program, it seemed to be received somewhat enthusiastically on the part of Democrats and Republicans last night. Let's start with you, Mr. Pleshinsky.
Well, I noticed that Speaker Pelosi was, got out of her chair and to applaud very energetically when the president mentioned comprehensive immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately I thought, well, she's happy about the possibility of many new Democratic voters. I think this is a problem on the right, at least the country as a whole, underestimates the extent of hostility to any kind of amnesty, or any president said he wouldn't be for amnesty, but that was just sort of a throwaway line. Anything short of a very hard crackdown is not going to appeal to many on the right, and that's a source of tremendous disappointment with President Bush on the part of the right. Of course, it's completely unrealistic, and I think this is a political a form of political suicide for the right to be so adamant against the presence in our country of 10 million plus illegal immigrants, because it's a done deal. You can't deport people like this, and you have to find they're integral to our economy, and some solution has to be found.
Mr. Millman.
Yeah, the real problem with immigration reform, as Mr. Pleshinsky says, are the divisions within the Republican Party, deeply divided over this subject. What Democrats have been saying for a long time, and what Democrats have supported, is legislation that says we got to get tough on the borders and stop illegal immigrants from coming here. We've got to get tough on employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants and give them opportunities that they shouldn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we need to take people who are here and provide them with a path towards earned legalization. Say to people who are here, if you have a job, if you learn English, if you pay taxes, if you obey the rest of the laws of the country, you can work your way towards citizenship. That's an approach that most Americans support. It's an approach that Democrats support. It's an approach, frankly, that I think the president supports. But there are a lot of people in the president's party who are very anti-immigrant, very anti-Latino, and that strain of anti-immigrant feeling in the Republican Party has really prevented the Republican Congress from dealing with this issue. We'll see if it can be dealt with the current setup.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about fuel efficiency in cars, global warming, et cetera, the president's response to that. It's an issue that has not been addressed in his previous State of the Union messages. What did you think about his ideas about how we lessen our dependence on foreign oil, Mr. Pleshinsky?
Well, that's a constant in our politics, and it's probably not possible in the near future. But it's a goal, obviously, because we are dependent on oil from countries that are unstable and not necessarily well-disposed toward us. But how we can get away from this, I don't know. I think we're an extremely selfish country. We don't allow drilling on our own shores. We consume this oil from other places, and yet we want to pretend we're living in some kind of Edenic environment where nothing is ever extracted from the earth, even as we drive here and there and fly here and there and need oil, creates huge demand for oil. So I think that's a problem we should address as well. But we attack offshore drilling as if it were just the wraith of the earth times 10, and I think that's outrageous. But again, no politician dares bring the subject up. Whenever there are a few efforts to do so, they're shut down very quickly. And so we're in that kind of situation where we're tremendous consumers and we don't do anything about the demand we create.
What about conservation? Do you think that's part of the equation?
We have to be realistic about it. I mean, Americans love their country and love the beauty of so many of its areas. So, of course, they'll want to preserve what they have. But at the same time, I think we can be serious about what we need and how we get it. The same thing, the president said nothing about nuclear power. Again, there's some kind of hysteria against it. It's a very safe form of energy and very cheap. Other countries use it. It caused no real problems. Why do we avoid it like the plague?
Mr. Mellon.
Well, it's hard to say Chernobyl and Three Mile Island were no problem. But it's also hard to say that we don't extract oil in this country. I mean, you can look at there's oil wells pumping on the grounds of Beverly Hills High School, for gosh sakes. So we do extract oil in this country. President's got the right goal. We do need to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. But the reality is he's embracing that goal in an extraordinarily timid way. He said 20% less gasoline consumption in 10 years. Read the fine print. He's not saying 20% less than we consume today. He's saying 20% less than we are projected to consume 20 years from now, which means, or 10 years from now, which means we are going to be burning vastly more gasoline than we are today, and we'll be vastly more dependent on unstable, undemocratic regimes in the Middle East, because that's where the oil is. The reality is we only have 3% of the oil in the United States. There's always going to be more in the Middle East. How do we get out of this conundrum? Well, part of the proposal it needs to be focused on alternatives. Democrats had been trumpeting this for some time. A couple years ago, the president eliminated the funding, most of the funding for alternative energy, gave huge tax breaks to oil companies instead. What Democrats are saying is we've got to focus on the alternative energy sources. We've got to build that infrastructure so we can deliver alternative energy sources. And frankly, we have at the same time to reduce our consumption of gasoline in cars. You know, we have the technology today to get higher fuel economy in cars. Everybody knows we have that technology. It exists. It's relatively inexpensive, actually absolutely inexpensive. And we just need to require that automobile manufacturers in the United States use that technology to get better fuel economy, to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. It's a matter of economics. It's a matter of national security. We should not have to be in a position of going to war for oil in this country.
We're
going to
welcome phone calls. The president did from my part of the speech that dealt with this, my notes on it. He mentioned clean coal, solar, nuclear, and ethanol. We could do talk shows on each of those, and we probably will in the weeks ahead. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address and hearing different perspectives from the editorial director of the American Spectator, Vlady Plushinsky, is with us. Democratic strategist Mark Mellman is also with us, and our phone lines are all crowded, but you'll get through eventually if you keep trying. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guests and start with Mike from New Berlin. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. If our kids and grandkids would have been listening last night, they would have heard something pretty disturbing. We're handing our kids currently a $49 trillion debt because we can't seem to approach the problems of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on the debt, which are going to consume 100% of federal spending by 2020. When the president mentioned entitlement reform, he got a lukewarm response from the Republicans, and he got no response. I saw virtually no clapping on the Democratic side. That tells me they have virtually no chance of approaching this huge problem for our kids and grandkids. What do the guests think?
Mr. Plushinsky, would you like to start?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I mean, we saw it with the president's efforts to reform Social Security. I mean, they were shot down by almost from the get-go, and he was almost ridiculed for thinking ahead. His own party wasn't much help. They were afraid. But the reality is our politics are extremely short-term. That is, in the House, people think only about the upcoming election every 2 years. So nobody wants to do something now to invest in the problem that would become more glaring 20, 40, 60 years from now. That's just the nature of our politics, and we have to kind of deal within that reality. It'll take some very smart political figures to find a way out of that. And also, as a country, we're pretty good in acting to short-term crises. And that, and apparently this is how this one is being regarded.
Mr. Millman.
Well, I think the reason Democrats weren't clapping is that we've had experience with George Bush over these last 7 years. We know that when George Bush talks about reforming Medicare and Social Security, what he really means is cutting those programs. That's what Republicans have tried to do year after year, time after time. And the caller's right. Democrats don't believe you reform Social Security and Medicare by cutting it. We want to protect those programs. There's lots of ways to modify those programs in ways that protect beneficiaries, but also remove this burden from our kids and grandkids. The real burden on our children and grandchildren is from this federal debt, from this federal deficit that this president has racked up. And Democrats have been talking about the need for fiscal responsibility for some time. The House, in its first 100 hours, passed, under Democratic leadership, passed a pay-as-you-go proposal that says, you know what, no more credit card debt. You can't put programs in the budget without paying for them. Yet we have a president who's spending what could end up being $1 trillion on a war in Iraq without putting that in the budget.
Am I still on?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, to the last speaker, the federal debt is $9 trillion. The obligated debt to our kids is $49 trillion. PAYGO simply addresses current spending. That's fine. That's something we have to do. But we have very little time to address entitlements. And if we listen to the last caller, we're simply never going to address it. We do have to raise taxes, and we do have to reform these programs. That's the only solution. We have 2 years of divided government, which is the only opportunity to address these problems. One party in power simply can't do it because they don't have the political will to do it because the public makes them pay if you dare reform Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. We have 2 years to do it, and we need to come together and address it now.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. In terms of whether or not this is high on the agenda of the American public, do we share Mike's sentiments, do you think, Mr. Pleshinsky? We want action on those issues, or would we put other issues as our priorities?
Oh, yeah, I don't think they're that high on the agenda. People kind of know that there are these festering problems, but our tendency is always to put them on the back burner. And I think Mr. Millman underestimates the degree to which younger Americans especially have no use for Social Security. There's a very aggressive tax on them already, and they don't expect that the money will ever come back to them in any shape or form that's meaningful. So I think President Bush, in his reform proposals, was trying to come up with a more efficient way of seeing to the younger generation's retirement future. And that was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And through the sort of points that Mr. Millman was making, that somehow he's out to destroy it or whatever. No, it's destroying itself. That's the problem. So how do you save something from self-destruction?
But it's unlikely that it's going to be dealt with in the next 2 years. That's the reality.
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the economy. We had two very different versions of how well we're doing from the president and then from the Democratic response from Senator Webb. The president saying the economy is on the move. It is growing. We've had 41 months of uninterrupted job growth. Unemployment is low. Wages are high. Inflation is low. And then we have Senator Webb saying that wages and salaries are at an all-time low and the middle class has lost its place at the table. Who's got the truth here, Mr. Millman?
Well, I think Senator Webb's got the truth, and the reality is your listeners can just ask themselves, do they feel like they're getting ahead in this economy? Do they feel like they can increasingly afford health care, increasingly afford a college education for their kids, a home, all the sort of basics of the middle-class lifestyle? The reality is they can't. The reality is it is more difficult for people today to afford a college education, more difficult to afford health care, more difficult to afford a home, more difficult to afford all the sort of basic constituent elements of that middle-class lifestyle. And yes, there are people getting rich in this economy. They are relatively few and relatively far between. Our good jobs are being exported. Yes, we're creating jobs. That seems to be the case. A lot of them are very low-paying jobs without good good benefits, and that doesn't really it helps President Bush stand up and say, I've created jobs. It doesn't help American workers afford a middle-class lifestyle.
Mr. Pushinsky.
Well, again, if numbers lie, then the statistical figures about our economy are lying. I mean, we've had years of uninterrupted growth, job growth, gross national product. You know, all indicators are positive, and to suggest that somehow things are getting worse in this environment is just, I think, politically motivated and a kind of it's a political lie. It's a big lie. I thought what Senator Webb was saying was nonsensical. To take one example, he complains that college is more expensive, less affordable. And yet again, we should look at the degree of federal involvement in higher education, and that creates all these disincentives to keep prices down. Of course, tuition keeps going up because government keeps pouring more money into subsidizing tuition. I mean, it's obvious. So why don't we deal with this honestly instead of through some sort of appeal to the allegedly the middle class that's allegedly under some sort of duress and decline.
I submit, though, you can't have it both ways. You can't say college tuition is more affordable, but the government's making it more expensive. It either is more expensive or it's not, and the reality is it is. And what the Democrats are trying to do is decrease the cost of student loans. I'm not sure how decreasing the interest rate on student loans makes college tuition more expensive, but the reality is it is getting more expensive, and therefore to say it's not is ludicrous. You know, the reality is, yes, the GNP is getting bigger, and there are the larger number of jobs, but the reality is individuals can't spend the GNP. It's not in their hands. They can't use that to pay for their health care costs or pay for their college tuition or pay for a home. They have to use the salaries and the benefits that they're getting. And relatively speaking, those salaries and benefits are shrinking compared to the costs of health care, college education, and the like. And so, yes, the economy is better off, but most individuals in that economy are not better off.
Let's go back to phone calls. Tom from River Falls. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Yeah, I wanted to address this to your other guest, Plazinski, who is telling a lot of lies here. Yes, the GDP did grow. The productivity gains have grown. Guess what? The workers aren't getting their share of those productivity gains. Somebody's stealing it. It's the CEOs that Webb talked about. Now, a reality check on health care. You said most middle-class families have gold-plated plans, and they don't need to have those plans, and they can sacrifice to help the uninsured. Well, my family has a health plan by one of the largest American companies that is one of the 30 companies in the Dow Jones Index. And for a family of three, we pay $380 a month, and for that, we have to pay 20% of the bill, and we have $30 per office visit. And like my wife just had her heart checked at the Mayo Clinic, and our share was $500 of a $3,000 diagnostic bill. So add the $380 a month plus the $500, blah, blah, blah. So the system's broke. You call Medicare a socialist system. 80% of Americans in our democracy support that, what you call socialist Marxist system. And so I'm sorry, the majority in our democracy like it. You guys tried this laissez-faire crony capitalism 60 years ago. We call it the Republican Great Depression, and you call Franklin Roosevelt a communist for fixing it. Go figure.
Mr. Pushinsky.
Well, the caller's putting many words in my mouth, so I can't exactly respond to the things I didn't say. But, again, if the caller seems upset out of a personal experience that he had somewhat expensive bills, most of which were covered by insurance. And I'm sure if things got worse, the insurance would cover the rest of it. But again, by contrast, we could suggest that he go to, let's say, Canada or Europe and see how much coverage he'd get there and what would be the quality of the care his wife received. And I suspect it would be a lot worse. So again, we seem to have an expectation that we can have a free lunch, and that we can have almost complete coverage and not pay a penny out of our own pocket. And I don't know where that has come from. I mean, I think the Democratic Party has perhaps created expectations of this sort in many voters.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. Mr. Millman, would you take on businesses? Because I've talked to a lot of businesses about this health care issue. We're hearing from a number of them that what they have to pay, it's benefit they want to give their employees, they just can't do it anymore. So it's not just the American public saying our benefits aren't very good. It's businesses who are being squeezed here.
Absolutely. And the caller who just was talking about his personal experience, it's an experience that a lot of people have. You know, he's paying more out of his own pocket,
yeah.
You know, up to, he said, I think $386 a month, almost, you know, $5,000 a year when all is said and done, out of his own pocket. Plus, his employer is paying more than whoever that company is, paying more than that company was mm-hmm. 5-10 years ago for that insurance. So the reality is, the employer's paying more, the employee's paying more, and as a result, we're in real trouble. I mean, you look at the auto industry, what they will tell you is that a large proportion of the cost of every American car is the health insurance benefits that they're paying, including the benefits for their retirees. Now, the way to solve that is not to ship all these workers or their jobs to Canada or to Europe. The way to get a hold of it is to reduce the cost of health care so that employers are paying less, workers are paying less. Mm-hmm. That'll be better for our economy and better for our middle class.
Yeah. Let's move to some other issues for a moment. And thanks very much for the call. We'll also go back to phone calls momentarily. What was this idea? He didn't flush out the idea, but what's this idea about a volunteer civilian reserve corps? Do you know much about that, Mr. Pluszynski?
No, I don't. But it sounds as a way to address a problem that we as a country no longer send our young people into military service as a routine, but rather just a certain segment of Americans serve and the rest of us take advantage of that. And I think there's a lot of guilt out there that we as a society don't have a kind of a shared sense of military service sacrifice and a sense of obligation mm-hmm. to serve our country. And again, I don't think there's any, nobody wants to return to a draft. People still remember the Vietnam era. But there is an effort to kind of create a certain sense of shared obligation.
Mm-hmm. Do you know more about this, Mr. Millman, what his idea is?
Hey, you know, I honestly don't, and I think it's sort of fascinating to throw out something like that with a name and a title, but without any explanation mm-hmm. Of what it is. It suggests the commitment doesn't run that deep.
Mm-hmm. What about what he had to say about the war on terror, about what he had to say about Iraq here? Is there anything new?
Well, unfortunately, there isn't anything new in what he said. You know, the president has put forward this plan to send even more Americans to Iraq. It's a plan that the Iraqi government is opposed to. It's a plan the Iraqi people are opposed to. It's a plan that most of our generals are opposed to. It's a plan that most Americans are opposed to. It's a plan that the bipartisan majority of Congress is opposed to, and yet the president insists on going forward with it. He says it's because we can't afford to lose in Iraq. But I must say, the seriousness of the stakes really have nothing to do with the likelihood of our success, nor with the likelihood of success of this particular plan. There are other approaches which are likely to be much more effective than simply sending more troops to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear what those approaches are. I thought Senator Webb had an opportunity to explain them, and he really didn't. He seemed to want to have it both ways, in that we withdraw rather quickly. At the same time, we resume the war on terror in a very serious way. So how are we going to do that by withdrawing from Iraq? I'd love to know the details.
Why do you think the president is adhering to a course that is not very popular, Mr. Pluszynski?
Well, of course, it's not popular. But 3.5 years ago, he appeared on an aircraft carrier, signed mission accomplished, written overhead. The assumption was we'd won, it was over, Saddam was out, no more problems. In fact, they were just beginning. And so there's a tremendous level of frustration and anger that it has come to this. We sort of went in into a country with no idea of how we were really going to win the peace there. And we're stuck and coming up with, you know, trying to come up with new ideas. And none of them that good other than than maybe sending in more troops so that we can secure Baghdad. I mean, that's a very sad statement, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frustrating to all those responsible for this, and then to many of, you know, very goodwill who backed the war and wondering, you know, why were we so unprepared? And was it something we could really prepare for? That's a larger question.
Well, but, you know, the reality is this president, this administration, has come to the American people time and time again since the president appeared on that aircraft carrier and before, saying we know exactly what we're doing. We know exactly where those weapons of mass destruction are, and we're going to get them. We know exactly how to win the peace. We know exactly how many soldiers we need. We know we don't need more troops than 150,000. We know General Shinseki is wrong. We know exactly what we're doing. And each time they have come to the American people and told us they know what they're doing, they've been wrong. And at a certain point, the president ought to sit back and say, you know what? I may not know everything about this conflict. I may not know the best way to achieve these goals. And when the Iraq Study Group gives me an idea, I ought to listen to them. That's my father's Secretary of State. When other people around the country and around the world offer suggestions, maybe I ought to listen to those, because he's been wrong every single step of the way with respect to Iraq. There are other alternatives. You know what? Most Iraqis believe that if the United States began to withdraw its troops, there would be less inter-ethnic violence, not more. Now, Mr. Pleshinsky and the president may say, you know what? The Iraqi people have no idea what they're talking about. We know much better how to run their country than they do. But maybe we ought to give the Iraqis a chance to run their own country. The Iraqi government said they didn't want these additional troops. The Iraqi people say they don't want these additional troops because they think if we begin to withdraw, we'll actually reduce the level of ethnic violence. And if we make it clear we're going to withdraw, other countries that do have an interest in a stable Iraq may well get involved, who are absolutely unwilling to get involved with George Bush, given the disaster he's created there. So there are other alternatives that are much more likely to work than the same kind of surge that we've done four times in the past in recent years, and it hasn't worked then, and it's not likely to work now.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the presidential State of the Union address and the Democratic response. We have two guests with us, Mark Melman, Democratic strategist with the Melman Group, and Vlady Pleshinsky, who's editorial director of the American Spectator. Our number is, one line is open if you've been trying to get through, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we will be talking about Iraq. Our guest spent 25 years as an award-winning investigative producer with 60 Minutes. He's written extensively about Iraq and produced a documentary about Saddam Hussein. He is now the author of Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. That's coming up, hour number two. Okay, let's go back to phone calls and to Chris from Eau Claire next. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to add a little bit to this reality about health insurance. I've been paying COBRA payments, and we're a professional self-employed family, and I'm only paying the COBRA payments out of savings at the moment, so we don't even have the income to pay this. I'm trying to look for something to take its place because I'm almost done, and I'm looking at $3,000 to $4,000 a year with $15,000 deductibles.
Mm.
And a recent article in Dollars and Cents says that if you have over a $1,000 deductible, you're twice as likely to avoid going to the doctor. So,
Mr. Pleshinsky, you want to start?
Well, yes. I mean, again, people are reacting based on their personal experience.
Well, sure.
When I think of my insurance, I often wonder, why does it get more expensive year to year to year? Because the care I'm getting is no different. And just individually, I prefer never to see a doctor if I can help it. So my tendency is always to run away rather than go toward a doctor's office. And I suspect a lot of people who are privately who pay for their own insurance entirely or self-employed and so on tend to get high deductibles because they'd rather not, you know, pay too much in insurance, and they have incentives not to see a doctor. So is that a problem? I don't know. I think it's something we can discuss.
Well, it's a problem if you get real sick, isn't it?
Well, yes, but who gets real sick as opposed to who isn't sick?
A lot of
if
people get very sick.
You go to a doctor's office and you see people waiting. How many of them are actually sick? I remember when my boys were young and we went to see his pediatrician, there'd be a sick room and a non-sick room. So the kids in the sick room would be, you know, running a fever and, you know, ear infection, something serious. But in the other cases, they weren't. They were just, being checked out, being tested. They needed a physical for school or something like that. So a lot of the care we get isn't that essential. I hate to be Scrooge on this, but I think that's my basic sense of these things.
Mr. Melman.
Well, I think it's not just being a Scrooge, it's being irresponsible. And frankly, I would urge you to go see a doctor, Ms. Leshinsky, as soon as you can, because you know what? If you get a physical on a regular basis, if you get those tests, you can avoid much more serious and much more expensive complications down the road. You know, you get a colonoscopy as an adult, for example, you save yourself from colon cancer. Treating colon cancer, dealing with colon cancer, much more expensive and much more difficult than actually getting that test every 5 years to make sure that you don't have colon cancer. To tell people not to go to the doctor to save money because they're not at death's door is just nonsensical.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Pat from Wauwatosa. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Kathleen. Again, on the health issue, we are in a situation where I have a daughter who suffers from chemical imbalance and depression, and because of her age now, she Obra, and it's extremely, extremely expensive. But the thing that just irritates me, her meds, for example, will cost us almost $900. And it's just every penny, no movies, no dinners out, nothing goes to that expense. And we're middle-class, hardworking people. The other thing is we lived out of the country for several years, and it was actually easier for us to get health care in that country. And even though Mr. Brzezinski and his cohorts would criticize those other systems, and they had their pitfalls, there's no doubt about it, but at least you can get the coverage, and there isn't the discrimination against people with mental illness like there is in this country. And to be quite honest, Kathleen, this gentleman that you have on this morning is an insult to my intelligence and to our country, I think, as well.
Thanks very much for the call, Pat. Let's go to Bob next from Merrill. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I just have kind of a simple question. I don't know if it makes sense, but our tax dollars are paying for all of our elected officials' health care benefits. And why are theirs getting paid for and ours are not?
Mr. Plushinsky.
Well, people in positions of power take care of themselves. That seems to be a rule wherever you go. But I think it's also a kind of, it might bring satisfaction to someone making that charge. At the same time, it doesn't change the reality that we're talking about a small select group as opposed to a more general situation. And I think most people are concerned about, you know, how things are for most people. And that's and how do we address that? Taking away coverage or special favors that select few enjoy won't change the reality that the rest of us face.
Well, it seems to me that congressmen and senators and whatever are making $100,000 or so a year. They could afford their own health insurance rather than having the taxpayers foot the bill when they can't pay for their own health insurance. That's my only comment.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Mm-hmm. And don't you find it rather interesting that here we are, the president spoke for almost an hour last night and devoted just a little bit of time, a very easy-peasy bit of time, to health insurance. And by golly, we're doing a response to State of the Union, and this is what everybody wants to talk about, Mr. Melman, health insurance.
That's right, and I'll tell you, we find this in our polling as well. The reality is that, you know, Iraq certainly is the dominant issue in the country. But once you get below Iraq, and when you talk about what people are concerned about personally, Illinois, right up there with Iraq, is concerned about the cost of health care, about the uninsured, about the cost of prescription drugs. Those are very serious issues for most Americans. Really, the largest number of Americans express among the greatest degree of personal concern about those health care issues, and that's what you're, I think, hearing in response to this program.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm struck at how, as a country, the richer we become, the more we do talk about matters of mortality, as if we don't, you know, that death is something we do not welcome, and we just want to eliminate entirely. And illness is a part of that. And I mean, when I was growing up, I just don't recall health care issues being on the front burner like this, even though we have more and more health care, better and better technology, more and more treatment, better treatments, saving, you know, more and more lives saved. And yet, people still seem to complain and fret as never before.
All right, let's move out of healthcare for just a moment here. What areas do you think now? The president outlined his ideas last night. The Democrats have already passed some legislation in their first 100 hours. Where do you see something big or something moderate happening where these sides get together and address, I don't know, foreign policy or domestic policy? Mr. Melman?
Well, I think energy is one area where there really can be a significant breakthrough. The president's proposals, as I said, I think really aren't exactly where we need to go. But the reality is the president's suggesting he's interested in joining the Democrats on this issue. Democrats have a very robust energy plan. A lot of businesses, a lot of our military leaders are also saying we can and must reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And I think you will see some real action on that subject in a bipartisan way. Second, the reality is there is going to be a bipartisan reaction on Iraq. A bipartisan majority of the United States Congress, both houses, is going to tell the president they don't like his plan. Now, that's not necessarily the president and the Congress agreeing, but it is Republicans and Democrats in the Congress agreeing that the president really needs to change his course, change his strategy with respect to Iraq. So on the congressional side, there is going to be some serious agreement there. I think the president will let the minimum wage increase go through. Democrats have been pushing that, got it through the House, go through the Senate. And I have to believe the president's not going to veto the first increase in the minimum wage in a decade in this country. So there are a number of proposals, a number of areas where I think there can be some real progress. But that's going to take cooperation on the president's side. The Congress is going to pass proposals.
Mm-hmm.
We need the president to join with the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress in trying to make those changes in the country's direction.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Pleshinsky.
Well, I don't expect progress on any front, really. Ruth Marcus, who's a liberal columnist for The Washington Post, today is rather critical of the Democrats and their knee-jerk opposition to anything Bush proposes. She suggests that Bush had come out and called for Hillary care, Democrats would have rejected it simply because it was coming from Bush. And if we're in this situation where a president is hated in such a comprehensive way by the opposition, I don't expect anything serious to be accomplished.
Well, he doesn't have a lot of support among the American people, Mr. Pleshinsky, at this point either, does he?
Well, if all the American people hear from media is just a trashing of him.
You think it's the media's fault?
The president who, remember, in the wake of 9/11, was, you know, his numbers were sky high. He'd show up at Yankee Stadium, and everybody
right.
would applaud.
Right.
It was, I mean, again, the public mood is fickle. And I guess there's a lesson here for any politician. Don't never believe the ratings you have, because they're not likely to last.
Well, some might say there's another message, too, but that's another show. Let's go to, and we're running short on time, everybody. Robert from Madison. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I believe that there are good Arab people out there. I believe there are good Sunnis, good Shiites. And I believe that if we let these people alone and eliminate us being the cause of their particular problems, that the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Turks, even the Syrians and the Palestinians and everybody else are going to solve their problems. They are not going to have the catastrophic situation that everybody is predicting is going to happen. And my goodness, if they get caught up in a war for a couple of years and they finally settle this thing and get it all settled out, We didn't have this. We didn't have so much of a problem in this country. In fact, there are Americans that don't even remember that there was a huge regional conflict between Iran and Iraq, and nothing was bad in this particular country. So I believe that we need to let these people solve their problems. And by the way, the Europeans would then start to get into trying to help solve these problems as well.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. And on that note, we'll have to say goodbye. We're plumb out of time. Mr. Pleshinsky, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
Yeah, and Mr. Melman, thank you so much for being with us
a
this
pleasure,
hour.
And please get that physical, Mr. Pleshinsky.
I don't know if he's going to rush to the doctor today. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for both of your contributions. Vlady Pleshinsky is editorial director of the American Spectator. You find them at www.spectator.org. Mark Melman is Democratic strategist, and he's at Melman Group, M-E-L-L-M-A-N group.com. Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing this hour and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. There will be more analysis of the State of the Union address. Ben Marins will be speaking with a professor of politics at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So, copy of the show, call the radio store, 800-747-7444. 124D is the program number. News is coming up, and we'll return with more Wednesday conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.